if you have a very big name that is a zombie company that needs dollars to service its debt, it will sell whatever assets it has in order to service that debt to stay in business. When the first big name falls, right, it's going to affect a bank on the other side, which is going to affect another borrower from that bank, and then you'll see dominoes starting to fall, and then all these zombie companies will default, and all of a sudden they won't need dollars anymore. You're going to have all these extra dollars in the system that people aren't demanding, and where are they going to go? They're going to go into the flight to real goods.
Here at Liberty and Finance, we're licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. We are standing by the inventory, ready to make sure you get what you need, even into the wee hours of night and on weekends, because preparedness doesn't stop. Call us 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're privileged to have this returning guest who's widely requested by our viewers. And when you look in the quality of comments under the interviews we do with this gentleman, you see how what a great amount of respect he garners among our subscribers. Rafi Farber is the founder of the Endgame Investor Newsletter and the Rafi Farber YouTube channel. He joins us this Thursday, March 9th, 2023. Rafi, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Thanks so much for having me again, Donegan. I really appreciate it.
It's later where you are than where we are, so I want to make sure we keep this on track so we don't take up too much of your late evening time. You just recently produced a podcast that I suggest people go find on your YouTube channel, the Rafi Farber channel on YouTube, because you did such a succinct and entertaining job of presenting the dire plight that the United States and frankly, many other Western countries find themselves in at the moment, trying to service the interest on the debt. We have all known since we were young that the debt was unthinkably large, but it became increasingly less concerning, perhaps for some people, because of the falling interest rate environment that we were in. That's no longer the regime that we're in anymore. And all of a sudden, it's a big deal from a budgetary standpoint, how any country can survive or ever recover from the kind of deficits that this combination of a high raising interest rate environment and an enormous debt is causing. And you broke it down very succinctly for the U.S. Could you show us and tell us why that's such a big deal and how you approached it from a very straightforward standpoint and a method of looking at it from the mechanics of how a country goes bankrupt?
Well, what you were saying before, that even though the debt was objectively very huge, very big, very large, any superlative you want to use, that we were in a zero interest rate environment basically since 2008, with a little bit of a hiatus in 2018, 2019, when rates went up to like 2.5% at most. So during that time, the debt itself was allowed to be accrued at enormous rates because of the zero interest rate environment. When you basically have free money, you can raise as much debt as you want at no cost. And though you are paying existing interest, your interest payments aren't really rising that much because you're borrowing at zero rates. And then something happened in 2020. And we all know what it was. And the interest rates went back to zero, and the federal government basically they raised like $2-4 trillion on the short term end of the curve. Now, when one mistake that a lot of people make, and it's understandable when they're calculating the debt, is they think let's say 10-year, 20-year, 30-year rates rise from let's say 3% to 4%, so then think that the government's paying 4% instead of 3% on that debt. But that's not true, because when the government sells a 10-year bond or a 20-year bond or some long-term security like that, they lock in that rate. They're going to pay, if they sold it initially 10 years ago, 20 years ago for 2%, they're going to still be paying 2% 20 years out now, into the future. The guy who buys it on the secondary market, if he buys it for cheaper because the price went down, he's getting more than 2% on his money. But still, initially, the government's paying 2% on the money that it got from that bond on the primary market. But it's different with short-term rates, right? So short-term rates are the rates that are rising now, like from 1 month bills. It's called the bills category. So 1 month bills, 3 month bills, 6 month. Those are the ones that are like 5.3% now, the same rate as they were in 2006. Right? Except in 2006, there were less than $1 trillion in the short-term debt total. Right? That was before the 2008 financial crisis, and now there's like $4 trillion. Dollars at the same rate of 2006, so it's like quadruple the amount of interest payments. Now every time that the government has to raise money on the short term, like 6 month or 3 month bills, and pay 5% on that, you know, that's going to really rack up the interest payments. And you know, with the debt ceiling debacle about to explode again, that's the only debt that they can really raise on the short end, and they're paying big interest on that. So on top of that, you have the notes category, right? In the notes category, you have 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, and 10 year. The 2 year and the 3 year, those were all, a big chunk of those were issued also during the lockdown crisis of 2020 and 2021 when interest rates were zero. And those short-term notes are also coming due now. So you have everything on the front end paying 5%, the 2 year and the 3 year coming due from when that huge deluge of debt was issued 2 and 3 years ago. And you're seeing the amount of interest payments on the national debt really start to go vertical. I think next quarter we should be at about $1 trillion a year.
And you were explaining in your podcast about this that the mirror image, and you just mentioned it, referred to it about how this echoes what was going on as far as an interest rate regime right before the global financial collapse of 2007, 2008, 2009. And yet how much larger the debt issuance is right now, against which we are going to try to, they're having to try to survive on a month-to-month basis making these interest payments. You talked about how that came right before the big recession, and now here we are perched again. Can you talk to us about the similarities you see between the setup and the magnitude of those two?
Well, in 2006, 2007, that was when interest rates peaked out two rate hiking cycles ago. So the interest payments on the national debt were rising, not as fast as they are now. I mean, I think I just did the, how we like to calculate the CPI in terms of annual rate of increase from a year-over-year rate of increase. So the year-over-year rate of increase of interest payments is like 41% a year now, and it's never been that high, not even in 1981 when rates were like 20% across the yield curve. So we're at that point now. It's not necessarily that the interest rates themselves were that prohibitive, or the level of interest payments that the government had to make. It could make them. I mean, they can always raise more short-term debt just to pay those interest payments. It's not like it's not going to happen. I mean, the only way that it won't happen is if they don't solve the debt ceiling crisis in time, and then they default technically on some of the bonds, and that could really trigger, an endgame scenario. I'm not predicting that. I don't think that's going to happen. But if it does, I'd probably laugh a lot. Not because I'm enjoying, all the fallout, but it would be unexpected and a little bit simplistic. But who knows? Maybe they're that crazy that they'll reach to those heights. But anyway, I mean, even now, the federal government could make $1 trillion, they could make those payments if they prioritize them. And they could even do $2 trillion or $3 trillion. I mean, but the thing is, you're on a hamster wheel, because the more interest you have to pay, the more you have to issue. And back in 2006, it wasn't as bad. Because 2007, 2008, it wasn't nearly as bad because the Fed was making all this extra money on buying all these bonds, right? So they had these earnings that they could remit to the Treasury, and the Treasury could use those to pay the interest that it owned on its debt. It was just money passing between the Fed and the Treasury. But now the Fed is undergoing losses every quarter, every week, and therefore they can't remit any money to the Treasury. So the Treasury has to raise that money from the market itself instead of the Fed providing it for them. So look, we're definitely at a hamster wheel. The question is, does a financial crisis happen first, forcing the Fed to lower interest rates again, or do we encounter a problem with the debt ceiling? I think there's going to be a financial crisis first, but whatever happens first, it's mostly a historical question. Something's going to happen to upset this balance very soon. Whatever it is, it is.
The other thing we haven't talked about in this part of the discussion is exogenous forces. So for example, foreign holders of U.S. treasuries redeeming those, or countries like the BRICS and the other nations, the other Eastern Bloc of the world that seem to be moving forward with the, going on with their lives and out underneath the, not no longer underneath the thumb of the U.S. Hegemony of the U.S. dollar, saying, which has been weaponized against Russia. We've seen other actions being taken against other countries to with sanctions and so on. So there, what about that phenomenon of the bifurcation or multipolar world we're moving into, where the U.S. dollar is not needed as much by those other countries as it once was? And how does that trend, if you see it as that, going to likely affect the sort of this balance point that we seem to be perched on, even though you said current short-term interest rates are going vertical, not interest rates, but interest costs are going vertical in the U.S. In addition to that, what do you see happening from foreign bondholders that would upset the balance?
Well, so I'll try to say two fundamental things about this, just to clear up the picture. So first of all, foreign bondholders, I mean, it's been, let's say since the 90s or the early 2000s, it's been just a piling on process where the deficits in the United States, the twin deficits, the trade deficits and the fiscal deficits, they just keep getting absorbed by foreign trade partners, mostly China and Japan. Right, those are the two biggest ones. So we could just, like, you know, minimize it to them too. And then, you know, the Republicans and the right wing in the United States say, oh, look at our trade deficits. This is horrible. And China and Japan are getting all the surplus, the dollar surpluses that we're exporting. Right. But in the end, what does that really mean? I mean, a trade deficit is funding stuff that goes into the United States. It goes into the country. And then the people of the country get that stuff in exchange for all the paper that China and Japan are holding. So the Americans get the stuff and China and Japan gets the paper. And now they're stuck with the paper and it's depreciating, and they're in a pickle, because if they sell it, then they lose their they lose most of their investment, because no one's going to take all that. You know, China has like 1.2 trillion or something, and Japan has even more. It's something around there. It's some crazy number like that. So I mean, this is coming to an end, in the sense that these Asian countries are no longer going to fund the consumption of the American consumer. Right, they're not going to be buying these bonds and shipping American stuff, or they'll do it for much higher prices. The second thing is that it looks like when the BRICS countries or developing countries you see these headlines of these currency deals to get around the U.S. dollar by using some other currency, I mean, I don't think that's quite getting away from the U.S. dollar, because other currencies are basically extensions of the dollar. Just, you know, in a derivative stack. So they're trying to get away from it in sort of an oblique way. But really, the only way you can get around the U.S. dollar completely is by going under it in the pyramid, right? If the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, and other currencies are just based on the U.S. dollar and some, you know, relic of the Bretton Woods system, that the skeleton of it that still exists now, the only way you can really get around the dollar is by using gold itself between parties. And that is happening to an extent. But I would discount news where it says things like the BRICS countries are looking to use local currencies instead of the U.S. dollar. It might have some kind of an effect, but if they really want to get around the dollar system, they've got to use gold itself as a settlement medium. And that's where we're headed. When we start seeing that, then the dollar is doomed. Until then, it's just an oblique way to sort of get around the dollar, but not really. So take that with a grain of salt, I would say.
What about commodity-backed currencies or commodity-backed trades that are starting to seem to be developing in the Asian bloc or the BRICS Plus association?
Commodity-backed trades, that also isn't so much getting around the dollar, because the commodity exchanges, they're mostly dollar-denominated exchanges. Right? When you're looking at futures markets, it's not all of them are. I mean, some are Chinese and And there's exchanges in Europe, but again, the euro is based on the dollar, and the yuan is based on the dollar too, because the yuan trades within a window of the dollar. So there's no really no such thing as commodity-backed trade. I mean, because for the same reason that there's never been such a thing as oil as money. Oil is a commodity. Commodities are tradable, but the money commodity itself is either gold or silver. So if it's any other commodity, it's still another way to talk about dollar trade, but in commodities terms. You're really still talking about dollars because most of commodities trade in dollars.
Some of the talk we've heard is about the Russia or China trading oil for certificates that are redeemable for gold. For example, you mentioned gold being a actual money, and establishing of new trading platforms or new markets, that is in Moscow or in Shanghai, etc., that are going to be based on physical commodities. Any thoughts that you have as far as, do you see that as a trend that has legs and is expecting to continue into the future? And will that weaken the primacy of Western historical commodity markets such as New York and London?
I do see it as a trend. I'm not trying to discount this completely and say it's nothing. It's not nothing. This is significant. But I think what you're seeing is the pieces, a skeleton of a new system forming with no meat on it yet, right? They're putting things in place to try to set up new exchanges. But once you have all the body parts in place and what's the let's say the Frankenstein scene where the lightning comes down and brings the thing to life. Like, what is that thing that's animating this new machine? It's going to have to be gold itself. And they could start by saying, oh, certificates that are payable in gold, but then you run the risk of inflating that, just like you run the risk of inflating any kind of paper system. It might start that way, but in the end, if this system is going to succeed, if everything that they're setting up now to get around the dollar, even though right now it's not getting around the dollar, but it's infrastructure to be able to do that, if it's not filled with physical gold and trustworthy on a reserve basis, it's not going to work. But it could work if they commit to getting around the dollar by getting under it and using gold and then using their own let's say currencies as substitutes for that gold, which would just mean that they're just trading gold and they have to be honest about how much gold is in their currency by not inflating. It's the same thing. They can't get around this inflationary system by creating another inflationary system. If they want to get around the dollar, they got to use honest money, which is gold and silver itself. There's no way around that.
Ordinary people who want to position themselves as best they can out of harm's way, given these strange times that we're moving through, and the concerns that people have about the advent of central bank digital currencies or other means of managing our freedom or lack thereof in the future world where we don't have privacy, we don't have freedom, we don't have the ability to hold on to real assets to really, again, own nothing and so-called be happy. People who are wanting to be able to have physical gold and silver in anticipation that they may be able to do direct transactions with others using those as a medium of exchange have all kinds of doubts in their mind about, is this really practical? Is it viable? Is it doable? Your thoughts on the most practical ways that people should anticipate or plan towards sort of managing their lives in the future based on real money, as you call it, and what are some of the difficulties around that, and then what are some workarounds for those difficulties?
Okay, so I'll address the worry and the fear first. Look, I totally understand, given that none of us have grown up exchanging gold and silver coins for pretty much anything, and they're just little trinkets that, even if we have a connection to them like you and I do, we've never really experienced what it's like to use them directly as money. It's still even a fantasy, even for us, even though it is a real thing, and it's the basis on which human civilization rests, because that's how division of labor came to be, with the use of money. So I'd say regarding the nervousness of how this is going to work, well, every time there is a financial crisis, every time in human history, from the beginning of money, everything has always gone back to gold and silver. So, when people have this idea in their heads that they can't really explain, and then they say, well, why is gold and silver always maintain its value? Because of some kind of magic, right? You could see it that way. I mean, magic is just a heuristic term that we use for things that we don't really understand. So we have this sense that gold and silver always retain their value and therefore it's magic. But really what's happening is that all the value of everything else, it becomes unknown until you reestablish some kind of measure against which you can, you know, calculate these things again. So you return to gold and silver. That's just because there's no other choice. There's nothing else you can do. And that's what we call gold and silver retaining its value. It's when the whole monetary system starts over again from the bottom and starts growing again, and you grow another pyramid, and eventually it leads to, you know, another Babel, and then it falls over and we start again. And it just keeps going over and over and over again. So in terms of practicalities, what you can do, I mean, look, I can't, there's no one size fits all answer to this. Since we don't know exactly how this is going to happen, you don't want to only hold all of your metals in your house and your safe. You don't want to only put it in a company, in a trustworthy company, or some overseas, some not overseas, gold mining stocks, whatever. But you do want some amount of gold and silver with you, and probably some amount stored with a company that you trust. You want to do a mix of these things. And in order to just calm yourself down, just the most practical thing I would do is start making connections with people around you, with local farmers or people that have skills, people that grow commodities, that grow food, that can do things that you need, and create a local circle, because we're going to be breaking up in a good way. And people are going to be more reliant on the people in their immediate circle, because we're not going to be able to, like, you know, go on Amazon and click a button and give them, you know, $50 for a trinket that they ship over here in you know, 3 or 4 days, and then, you know, that, and kumbaya. It's not going to be that way. That's globalized world, and that's breaking down for the good. We're going to be more reliant on local supplies. So get to know your local area and have some gold and silver to be able to trade with your neighbors, with your city, with your county, and make connections now so that when this happens, you'll know where to go, you'll know what to do, and you won't be screaming or nervous. You'll be a little bit nervous, but you'll have a plan. That's what you want.
We have to applaud the efforts of at least 14 states in the U.S. right now that are enacting or at least voting on legal tender laws for gold and silver, trying to reinforce and reestablish the primacy of gold and silver as legal tender for debts, public and private. Different states have been repealing sales tax laws on bullion, for example. Some states have been passing laws that allow them to store any budget surplus that the state may have partially in gold and silver. Some have been establishing gold or silver repositories within the state. Some have even started passing laws that say that the state will protect the property rights of their citizens of their state who have metals physically deposited in those depositories against overreach from federal government, etc. So those sound like promising actions being taken at the state level to help support a ecosystem within which smaller and local communities and so on can potentially have a better shot at being able to rediscover, as you say, mankind always does, the primacy of gold and silver in tough times when the confidence has broken down in the existing or previous system. Can you talk to us about other evidence you're watching of likely ways that the confidence, whether it's confidence of retail citizens or whether it's the confidence of other foreign countries or others, is likely or at risk of failing in the fiat currency system, whether it's the U.S. or any other country?
So evidence that the world is losing confidence in the fiat system. The first part, how you're setting up the question, I want to respond to first, that how I look at states, you know, making legal tender laws or dropping sales tax on gold and silver, collecting repositories of real money and saying that they'll keep it safe from the federal government. These are positive things, but it's dangerous to rely on them in the sense that, oh, I'm going to move to Wyoming or Nebraska or Texas because they're creating gold and silver depository and they'll defend it from the feds. Maybe they will. But how I see these developments are less of, okay, this is practically going to help me. But I do see it as a positive because it shows that the culture from the bottom up is speaking out and returning to honest money, even if whether it's practical or not. What a state government or a city government or whatever positive actions they take is really reflective of the people in the state, that they are waking up. And that's what I think is important, whether or not they can actually, you know, defend their gold and silver hoards from the FBI if they come and take them. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I hope they can. And in terms of the breakdown of confidence in fiat currency as well, I mean, you have what's happening with central banks and they're buying gold. I think the amount of gold that central banks have bought in the last quarter, or was it in the last month or something, was the most since 1968 in the fall of the London gold pool. I mean, look, the confidence in fiat currency is the inverse of the price of gold in that fiat currency. The cheaper gold is in the fiat currency terms, the more confidence they have. But when people lose confidence in the currency, that's when they buy gold. You know, that's the action of losing confidence in fiat currency. That's why we stack, because we don't have confidence in it. So what's keeping it up now? You could ask, and why did gold and silver sell off when, let's say, Powell wanted to raise rates by 50 basis points instead of 25? Well, that's a technical, you know, issue, where the higher interest rates go, as long as debts can be serviced and there aren't waves of defaults, then the priority for companies that need to stay in business is they need to service their debts. And the higher interest rates go, the more dollars they're going to need. So they're going to bid on those dollars for, you know, with whatever assets they have, just to stay in business. That's going to stop when they start defaulting and they're out of business. And then the demand for dollars falls. And that's when the demand for gold goes back up, when the financial crisis happens. So we're nearing that inflection point when we see defaults start to rise and rise. You know, people think, oh, that's deflationary and the price of gold will fall. No, it's the opposite. It's going to go up. Right now, higher interest rates are raising the demand for dollars, which is temporarily pushing the price of gold and silver down, which makes it seem that confidence in the dollar is increasing. But really, this is just the financial stress you always see before a financial crisis, nothing more than that.
Yeah, I was hoping we could get to this, because you've mentioned financial crisis a few times and we haven't really poked that. But when you started mentioning defaults, that's reminding me to open that door. This has been written about recently by multiple analysts as a key turning point in the in a financial collapse or in the bankruptcy of a country, that sort of thing. When you start to get a cascade of defaults by companies, by municipalities, by governments, whatever. Can you talk to us about why that's such a key moment? And with the number of zombie companies that we have in the U.S., for example, which have been skating along because of this low interest rate environment that they've been subject to for the past, you know, few decades, how is that going to be changed? How is that already changing now? And what's that likely to do to trigger the evidence of these defaults? And then how is that going to impact the ability of the currency regime or the banking regime to maintain any sense of solvency in the face of those defaults?
Zombie companies, I forgot the exact definition. Is it that their earnings are just enough to pay the interest on their debt? Is that what it is?
Or not enough to.
Not enough to, right? Like, they don't actually make money. They make just enough money to, to survive without a soul. Right. So the minute that interest rates go up, they can no longer service that debt and they start to default. So I forgot what percentage of companies in the world or the U.S. are zombie companies, but it's a very large percentage. And the demand for these dollars, you know, they are the highest. The demand for these dollars is the highest among the most distressed zombie companies, because they're, you know, within a hair's breadth of going bankrupt and everyone there losing their jobs. I mean, you could have a humongous company that's a zombie company that's a very big name. I can't think of one on top of my head. I don't look at these balance sheet all the time, but if you have a very big name that is a zombie company that needs dollars to service its debt, it will sell whatever assets it has in order to service that debt to stay in business. When the first big name falls, right, it's going to affect a bank on the other side, which is going to affect another borrower from that bank. And then you'll see dominoes starting to fall. And then all these zombie companies will default, and all of a sudden they won't need dollars anymore. So who's going to, you're going to have all these extra dollars in the system that people aren't demanding, and where are they going to go? They're going to go into the flight to real goods, right? I heard today something, Mario Ineco, Monaco 64, who was quoting Mises in German, right? I think he knows German. And he was saying that the way to translate crack up boom, the way Mises described it, was the flight to real goods, right? That's the literal translation of the crack up boom in German. It's not really, we have all these technical terms for it, but really all it is people trying to save themselves and get whatever they know has tradable value. So when the zombies, when they fall over, right, what you could say, we're already in the zombie apocalypse because all these zombie companies are keeping the world alive. So when the zombies die, it will be free. And the zombie apocalypse that we're all looking forward to is really the end of the zombie apocalypse we're already in. We can all look forward to that.
Something you mentioned just a moment ago was the potential of a very large company that's already not profitable, just barely making their payments. The interest rates go up. They can't make their payments. They close down, lay off tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of workers. That raises the question at the individual household level for those workers who are laid off. But that same phenomenon, the way you described it, the financial realities of a zombie company can also be applied at the household level. The number of people that are living basically on debt and have only been able to get by because of the low interest rates, it hasn't made it obvious that they're insolvent. Can you talk to us about how that even boils down to the individual and household level?
Right. Well, if you want to translate the term zombie company to a zombie household, not to put all the characteristics of zombies on a household that's, you know, living hand to mouth. I mean, I understand there's a lot of people in this situation, but it is soul sucking in the sense that you feel that you're in a rat race and you can't dig yourself out of it, and you have no prospects. And what are you going to do? If you find yourself in a zombie situation where you're stuck, then a default and resetting yourself is going to be painful, but it allows for a fresh start. Hopefully, you're relatively young when this happens. It's going to be the worst. It's going to be the worst for the older generation, 60s, 70s, boomers who are still in a zombie situation. And I feel for them, and I don't really know what to do about them, which is why I'm trying to communicate to the younger generation that has a chance of getting out of this relatively unscathed if they act now. So when these zombie households fall over, hopefully they're young enough to get out of their trance and find bottom with the rest of the deflationary crash that's happening, and then start over. And it happens a lot in life. People have to start over, and it's scary, but it's also very liberating if you handle it right. So the best I can say is look forward to it, and if you handle it right, it can be the start of a new life. So you don't have to fear it. Let it come.
So that's how an individual can weather that storm and emerge intact. There's the other aspect of looking at that in aggregate. If you have hundreds of thousands or millions of households that are doing that at the same time, how that affects the macroeconomy of any country when you have these waves of layoffs, waves of bankruptcies, waves of defaults against consumer loans and that sort of thing. How does that roll up when you look at it from a macro accounting standpoint? You roll that up to the national level, for example.
Well, let's see. So you have all these companies that defaulted on their debt, and all this you have all these extra dollars floating around, and all these other people without any purchasing power because they've defaulted, so they can't afford any. They're poor because they don't have dollars, but you have all these extra dollars from these defaults. So where do those dollars go? They go to buy up the real goods that are available, leaving these people without any money because they've defaulted or they're bankrupt without anything. And you have this very big imbalance of resources where prices are pushed so high that people on the street can't afford them. And that is the hyperinflationary cycle. That is the end game. That is the flight into real goods. But most people can't even afford it. So they just spend whatever they have to get whatever they can get. So that is what is going to happen until the monetary medium itself just doesn't work at all anymore. And then you have to have everyone find new jobs, find a new division of labor based on something real to plug in the skills that they actually have to someone who actually needs them, right? And then what happens is you have a rebalancing of society, right? Instead of like academia talking about, transgender rights, these professors saying whatever they're talking about, I don't even want to follow it anymore. Instead of that stuff, academia, for example, would be honed down to things that actually advance humanity instead of nonsense, which is being subsidized by the government, which is the inflation machine. So you're gonna have much leaner sectors, but in the meantime, there's gonna be a lot of people that have nothing, and they're gonna have to find a way to get money if they don't acquire it now by trading whatever skills they have for it and reintegrating into a new division of labor, which is not easy.
Yeah, it sounds like not easy is a good way to describe the times ahead. And we don't know how long that's going to last, just the existing aging baby boomer generation. But then what about our children and our grandchildren and so on? I got this so-called helpful letter from the Social Security Administration recently at my household. And it made reading over this, I was going to ask you a question about this. Reading over this, it reminds me of how it's been told, and I think it's true, that any law or bill that comes out of the Congress is always named the opposite of what it actually does, such as the 2010 Dodd-Frank Consumer Protection and Banking Act, which basically made us all subject to bail-ins by the banks and so on and so on. The Patriot Act, which took away a lot of our constitutionally protected rights and that sort of thing. This one is called Retirement Ready. Came from the Social Security Administration fact sheet for workers, and it talks about things like your benefits will last as long as you live, and it says, but if you're working while getting benefits, and so you just talked about people who may find that, and we've heard it also said when people said, well, is Social Security going to be there for me? And they address that on the back, and well, nominally you may get the numbers on your paycheck or whatever from Social Security, but what will that actually buy you in this fiat currency that's withering away if the value of your currency is actually dropping by 6, 10, 12, 20, pick a number, percent per year, and your benefits are sitting there flat, then your lifestyle is actually going down, down, down on a compounded basis. But it's worse than that. But wait, there's more, because it says, Social Security will be there for you when you retire. That's one of those lovely headline statements. Social Security will be there for you to retire. And it says, basically, based on current law, the trust funds will be able to pay the benefits in full and on time until 2034. So that's 11 years from now. They're basically saying, folks, we're going bust. And that's how you spin, we're going bust, is we'll be there for you when you retire. And it says after that, they could still pay $780 out of every $1,000 in benefits. So again, those are nominal dollars. So not only will the dollars be shrinking and worth less and less every year, but after 11 years from now, they're going to be bust, and we'll have to pay less than the nominal amount that they should have. And oh, but wait, there's more. It says if you work while getting benefits, then they're going to withhold and postpone and not give you some of the benefits that you otherwise would have been receiving. So for those people who are entrepreneuring, ingenious, hard industrial worker, work ethic people who go out and get it done and say, I'm not going to settle for this shriveling gravy train that's drying up, I'm going to go do something with myself. Well, that'll make the gravy train just go away entirely. So the whole takeaway I have from this paper is don't put any hope that Social Security is going to get you through your retirement years or your rest of your life in any kind of comfort or, you know, any thriving. If you're going to do any thriving, you're going to have to do it outside of that and despite that system and despite a lot of other intrusions from the government. Any thoughts that brings up for you, or any observations from you on people looking forward to entitlement programs taking care of them in the future?
I recently got a letter in the mail from whatever tax authority or whatever authority it was, and I'm in Israel, that said that I have to invest a certain amount of shekels in some kind of retirement fund, and if I don't, I'm going to get fined 500 shekels. So I'm like, okay, so you're telling me I have to invest, what was it? I think it was like 7,000 shekels minimum every year in these government securities or whatever they want me to buy, or I have to pay 500 shekels. So I'm like, either I'm going to lose 7,000 shekels or I'm going to lose five. So okay, fine, I'll just pay the fine. Just leave me alone. So same kind of thing. Like the way I think about it is like all these retirement scams, and the first one was started by, who started Social Security? Well, it was the guy who stole all the gold in the country. That was the guy who started Social Security in 1934. I think it was the same year that was Social Security was started in 1934. Was that it? I think that was the year. And it was the same year that he took the entire gold supply. So not only conceptually is all of Social Security, that check that you get from Social Security, the value that you can buy with that, the fact that you can buy stuff with that check is only because the dollars are still exchangeable for some amount of gold. So then just why don't you just like acquire the gold itself and forget about the stupid check? Just buy what makes that check valuable, and then you can bypass the whole system. So also historically, since the system was founded by the guy who stole all the gold, it makes sense. So forget about Social Security and just get the medal. And then worry about the default later. Because if you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, even 70, this could happen in the next 2, 3, 4 years. It could even happen this year. That this whole system is going to fall very, very quickly. So any faith that you have in government is really in a derivative stack faith that you have in gold and silver. So just go directly for the money.
Another thing we haven't talked about, and we should touch on at least briefly, is the demographic winter on its way. Jordan Peterson just did an excellent interview that people should check out on that, called the Crisis of Unplanned Childlessness. But it's sweeping across the West, industrialized nations, Japan and others, but it's also coming to all of these countries, where the countries are getting to a level of childlessness that no culture has ever recovered from in the history of the world. And that should bring us all pause, because just as we've been talking about this unpayable debt that's piling up, and that was based on this low interest rate environment, it was based on more than just a low interest rate environment. It was surviving also based on a growing workforce. Now that we're having a shrinking workforce and a aging retirement, people that need ever more expensive care, and that's another whole topic, the expense of care and how that's really a profit center for some specific industries. But this is another mega trend that's going to be happening over the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, is this inexorable reduction in the amount of number of productive workers trying to support the increasing number of those who are in the retirement years. Any thoughts about that being yet one more force that's going to be coming into this collision of retirement plans, solvency, et cetera, states that have their pension plan solvencies, et cetera?
Well, it fits into the culture that unsustainable debt has built. Because again, it turns people into zombie people, it turns companies into zombie companies, and then you're stuck in a sort of the introduction to the movie Idiocracy, where the educated people, they don't have enough kids, and then you can't continue society like that. I mean, you're battered down with debt. You feel that you can't have children, or you don't have time to commit to another person to in a marriage and to raise a family. But the first the we talk about the Bible, you and me, fairly often. So the first commandment that God gives mankind in the Bible is to be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply, because if you don't do that, then all the production that you think that you are engaging in, what you, if you're a manufacturer, or you create technology, or you create art or architecture, whatever it is that you're doing, if your culture isn't creating the next generation, then you're not really producing anything, because no one is going to appreciate whatever it is that you produce, and it will just be nothing. So if you don't produce children, you're not producing anything. I'm not saying that everyone has to have kids. Some people, that's not their job. But as a culture, as a society, if you're going to have a value of, kids aren't the top value for the society, then you don't have a society in the most in the literal sense of the term. And that goes along well with all the nonsense that has been fed to us by governments, and at the source of it all is the fiat currency that has corrupted everything. And it's not going to last forever, because once fiat currency collapses, then people will go back to their roots of starting families again. It's going to take some time, but people are going to need support through this, and not just friendly support, but soulmate support and family unit support, where they can get emotionally through life without all of this nonsense comfort funded by inflationary theft.
Right. We'll talk about that, I think, in a future interview, is about the foundation of a healthy society, because you've got a lot of ideas about ways that we can establish more healthy, sustainable, parallel systems outside, and as you say, below in the pyramid, more foundational in the pyramid financially, but it sounds like also societally, and that's based on healthy families as the fundamental building block of a healthy society, just as healthy cells are the fundamental building block of a healthy organism. Love to talk more about that with you soon. Rafi Farber, founder of the End Game Investor Newsletter and the Rafi Farber channel on YouTube. Any parting thoughts for our viewers before we wrap?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a situation now where, we look at the price of gold and silver, and we look at it every day, and sometimes it's depressing us. When is it going to happen? When's the moonshot? How long is this going to last? But really, that itself is another system of the inflationary system we're in, because we're on our phones all the time, checking, looking at the chart and this and that, and that's a problem in itself. And I admit that I have that problem also, and you try to escape it, but like all this technology, it's inescapable in some ways. So when you realize that maybe you're looking at this a little bit too closely, just relax. Everything's fine. Like, conceptually, you got it right. And just back off from the system a little bit. You'll be okay.
There's a allegory I remember from a motivational speaker, Lou Tice. He talked about, you remember the farmer who was trying to make sure that his plants were growing, so he pulled them up to see how the roots were growing. So yeah, sometimes we can get over-focused on something and forget to be just present in the moment that we do have, which is now, and be present with those whom we love. If you have the cucumber plant, you have that. You don't have to worry about what it's trading for on the market right now. It's a productive asset. It's something that's of life, and it's going to help sustain you in the future. So anyway, so much more to get into in the future. This has been kind of a very wide-ranging discussion, but kind of gives us a feel for some of the areas that things are changing around us, and then some things that are unchanging and eternal that we can remember to stay grounded on in the environment, which is can be very confusing, can have the winds buffeting us about, the storms come, but if we got our feet on the solid rock, solid ground, we'll be in better shape, and we're grateful for your presence here with us in that. Thank you, Rafi.
Thank you, Dunnigan. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A+ rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency.
Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.